All right, we'll start here. Welcome, everybody. I'm Dan Mortensen. I'm the chair this year of the section, and we're excited to learn about speaker building tonight. Without any further ado, one of the new members of our committee, Dana Olson.
All right. Well, so I'm Dana Olson, and a new committee member just in August, and I got to sit around at the August planning meeting, and one of the things we thought, gosh, we're having this speaker contest coming up at the DIY Club. Let's have the poor soul that wins that thing come down here and tell us how he did it. And then I made the mistake of winning. So here I am. I'm great. That's beautiful. And so the DIY Club contest is the brainchild of Mr. Terry Olson, who's here. And he's going to come up and just tell us a little bit about the contest first, and then I'm going to go on and talk all about how I design speakers.
Sure.
We haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. You want me to use that microphone right there?
Or whichever. There's a handheld here, too, if you'd like.
No, that's fine.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Usually you can't drown me out. But anyway, I came up with this idea a number of years ago, about 40, and I was in college. And I was doing some research at the time on the psychology of sound and the effect of sound. And it just kind of branched out. And it was, what are the psychological effects? What affects your perception of sound? And how this translates to speakers is, say, somebody has a red cabinet. Does that sound better to you than the one that's, you know, orange? Or black, or what, you know. And so anyway, 40-something years ago, there wasn't a lot known. There was a lot of people had a pretty fair idea of maybe what the effects are. But there wasn't any data. And so that's what we did. We actually got some funding. And it got to be real interesting. Well, anyway, this contest was an outgrowth of that. And so basically, what it was we found out that sighted perception does shade one's opinion about what they're hearing. In other words, what you see affects what you think you hear. And so basically our contest that I spent some time thinking about and then finally put it together is that we have a curtain that is acoustically transparent, hopefully. And then we have some judges sitting on the other side. The contestants' speakers are on the far side. They can't see them. Okay, so far, so good. That sounds great. Well, there's a lot more problems. And one is the levels. And what are you using for the testing and all that. So what I'm going to do is try to give you a brief overview of how the contest kind of works. And then Dana can tell you about it. Where'd they go? Oh, there. His award-winning speakers. So basically, we have this curtain. We have we put together as good a system as we can figure out. You know, good amplifier, good preamp, state of the art. If we can pull it together, then the judges. We usually have three judges. And what they do is they choose a piece of music, a selection about 2 minutes, maybe three at the most, of something they're very familiar with. And each one of them says, well, I want to listen to this. Or they can have a couple of them shorter because the time element is very important because we have to get through in a day on this. So they would choose that, and we would get it recorded on a CD. And we usually have a few copies. I don't think we have one with us today. Did you bring it? Anyway, we usually have Winston Ma used to put them together. I don't know if you're familiar with Winston or not. But he had an audiophile label, FMI. FIM, I guess it was. Yeah, First Impression Music. And it was really, really top-notch recordings. And so we would have him or someone else record these things on a CD. we would then bring in the judges with the speakers set, already set up behind this curtain. The levels had been adjusted. We put a test tone through, and then we'd adjust it. So every speaker that's in the contest is playing the same music at the same level, and the judges can't see it. And hopefully it kind of evens it out quite a bit. And so anyway, then we have several classes. We'd have a one-way thing, a two-way thing. Oh, you got that on there, too?
Yeah.
Oh, let's see here. Oh, I know these guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Where are we at? Oh, come on.
Well, I don't know what that
button is. My wife does the TV at home because she doesn't trust me. You can see.
Oh, there we go.
While he's looking for that, can I ask you a question, Terry?
You can.
So you have one amplifier there that's sequentially connected to each speaker in turn, or you have
multiple
amplifiers?
Okay. What happened, I better talk into this so everybody can hear me. Basically what it is they'll bring in a pair of speakers and they hook it up. We have a crew that does this. And while that's taking place, the judges have to stand outside. And usually it's a clear day because we do it during the summer. But if it's raining, they still got to go outside. It doesn't make any difference. They don't get to hear. They don't get to see anything. They come in. They sit down. We play those selections of music. They're scoring it. We have a standard score sheet.
Yeah, that part I get. Well, tell me about the setup of it.
Okay.
The mechanics of it.
As soon as they're done scoring it, guy comes around, collects them. They go back outside. The speakers are taken out of the room, and the next set is brought in.
But the amplifier stays.
Same amplifier,
yeah. Everything is the same except for the speaker. That's our goal. Okay. And we try to set it to the same level. The judges listen to the same thing.
Same level?
Oh, we have a microphone and everything. We try to get it within about a quarter dB.
Okay. And are you doing a single tone, or are you pink noise, or what?
Pink noise.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're doing one pair of speakers at a time?
Like, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you've got one set of speakers, they listen to that, they go outside, you change it, they come back in and listen to the next set.
Yes.
And in the meantime,
so
you've calibrated.
Presuming that they have good sense or hear memories that can remember what exactly they heard 5 minutes earlier.
They're scoring these on their perception as they hear it.
So it's new each time, essentially, since you can't remember that long.
Actually, our judges have a very good memory, as a matter of fact, and better than average, I can tell you that for a fact.
Are those who are judging sort of at the apex of the triangle? I mean, are they in a pretty good location?
Yeah, they're sitting about 8 or 9 feet away from the speakers on the other side of the blind.
Is that, yeah, so.
And
are those
they,
judges there?
Huh?
That wasn't during
day. No.
Oh.
Actually, one of them's me, and you wouldn't want me to be a judge.
That's the setup. The curtain's just been raised down the way. This was after the contest was over, but this is the setup.
You can see how it's set up. Now, the curtain is rolled up.
Right.
Actually, it's down when the contest is actually taking place. There's a door right over in this area that the judges leave the room after they've run through, and then the crew comes in on the other side of the curtain, hauls the speakers away, and brings in the next set. And then they're told that they can come back in the room. They're given a new score sheet, and it starts over again. They hear the same music, and the only difference is they all shift over. There's three seats, and then there's a guy sitting. He'd be over here that is running the controls and stuff for the test tones and all that sort of thing. He's the only other one that's in the room, allowed in the room during this contest.
Is that at the church, that particular?
This is at the church, yeah.
That's in Mercer Island.
On Mercer Island, right.
Mercer Island.
This is the room off to the side where the meetings usually are. If you go through that door right, yeah, I can't reach up, behind the speaker, yeah, you're in this room here. So. I know that guy. He's sitting right over there.
Yeah, this is the other room where.
Yeah. This is where our meetings usually are for the stereo club. And you can see...
You can see the nervous contestants waiting.
Yeah. So this is kind of a sampling.
So they're not really doing the... You're not really set up to do A-B testing then?
No, we don't do A-B testing. Each one is done on its own and is judged on its own.
Yeah. One question about you say everybody's familiar with the music. You mean they're familiar with the recording of the music? Is that the idea, that particular...
Oh, they may be familiar with the actual music, too. I don't know. One of them actually is a conductor.
Is it orchestral music?
Yeah, sometimes. No, not all of it. I mean, they choose what they think. It has to be something they're familiar with, and they feel they can judge the quality of a speaker from. Yeah, I know. If it was up to me, it'd all be classical music. But like I say, I don't make all the rules. Yeah.
Do the contestants have the music ahead of time?
Hmm?
Do the contestants have the music ahead of time?
No.
Okay.
Do they know what the speakers are going to be playing with? Do they have any amp characteristics?
I'm not hearing you. I'm sorry.
Do they have any amplifier characteristics? Or are they just told that they are going
to
use...
We usually try to tell them what amplifier we're going to be. For years, we used a set of tube amplifiers that Gary Cole had designed and had built. And they were excellent. Mm-hmm. For a tube amplifier, they would actually play a speaker down to a half ohm with no problems whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever built tubes, you know that's pretty hard to do. But yeah, we try to keep it as even as we can for all the speakers. The judges don't know what's behind the curtain. They're not told. All they're doing is evaluating what they're hearing. And they have here's a copy of the evaluation sheet right here. And
do you want to hit the microphone again?
I can do the microphone too. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. We have different things that they're grading, evaluating a speaker with. And one is the total balance, which is about 50% of the score. And various things are, I'll tell you what, I'll just read them off. Freedom from coloration, I can't even talk anymore. Octave to octave balance, bass treble balance, high frequency extension, and low frequency extension. And they're allowed to make a 1 through 10 and mark off where they think that speaker, you know, lands on that. Then the next one would be spatial reproduction. That's 30% of the total score. And sound is open and transparent. Depth, stage height, and width. And each one of those has a separate deal that they would score, 1 through 10. Then you go to the dynamics and distortion. That's 20%. Clarity and soft passages. Spectrum shift. And that's as the volume increases or decreases, does it change anything, right? Okay, and then imbalance, wait a second, that's part of it too. The imbalance begins to occur. If anywhere you start getting shifts, of course that detracts from your total perception of the sound, and you get marked down and that lowers the score too. I mean, they can go negative on you too. So anyway... I know I've built enough speakers to do just that. Artifacts, and these are the subtractive, the big subtractive thing. That's all they do. And woofer bottoming, okay? This is where I always get knocked down. For years and years, haven't done it this last time, but I bring in a set of single speakers. I made out of Radio Shack woofer in a box. And it actually sounds pretty darn good, but it does not go loud. I got it to go low, but it won't go loud. And, you know, that's how it works. But I bring it in, and every time I brought it in, we have this contest every other year. And so the judges have almost every time noted the same problems that they experienced with it and the same strengths. Well, what that indicates to me is they're still hearing what they've been hearing all along. And they're not losing it. So I've never won with those speakers because they're just not quite good enough. But I get the same type of report each time. So And then,
Terry, one question on that.
Yes, you
what
can.
What is maximum sound pressure level at the listener's ear? Do you guys have a measurement?
Basically, we set that. We run a test tone, and that's dialed up. And I think it's about 78, I think. And then everything is louder or quieter, you know. So.
Oh, you mean the average is maybe 78, 78?
Yeah, right. So. Yeah, we want all of them to have, you know, if you play it real loud, then some speakers will do well with that and others are going to fall apart. What we want to do is kind of reproduce what you would normally expect in your own house. You know, and that can vary from house to house, obviously. But we're trying to find kind of a happy medium that's fair to everybody, you know. So that's what we kind of landed on. I mean, I'm sure some do better than others because of it. But we haven't figured out a way to make it perfect for every speaker that somebody might conceivably construct. So, and then the last one we're looking for, or the last two, vent noise. And our guys have gotten really good at that, getting away from it, I mean. And so every year we notice that the quality of sound has improved, or every contest rather. And we've got guys, I remember some of the guys when they first showed up the first time, they weren't very good. And now they're just, you know, they're really, really phenomenal designers. They've really worked their way up. We've been doing this contest for, good God, I don't know, 12 years, something like that, I think. Every other six? Yeah, that'd be about right. About 12 years now. And so people, have their skill increases. There's no doubt about it.
Who can compete?
Well, we were kind of limited to who actually can compete. You have to be able to prove that you're actually a living being. Walking upright on two legs, you know. Other than that, it's pretty wide open, I think. You know, I can't imagine who wouldn't, you know, who would be turned away, honestly. So, anyway, that's kind of what we're doing. Are there any other questions about the contest itself?
Are the speakers on the ground or lifted or variably?
What we ask people to do now, obviously, if they're a floor standing speaker, it's no problem there. If you have a small speaker and you usually listen to them on stands, we ask that you bring your stands with the speakers. You know, presumably you find that a good combination rather than us finding old catalogs and piling them up, you know, to get them up to a certain height. So, yeah. But we get some phenomenal entries, really. Let me ask a question. How many of you guys have ever attempted to build some speakers for yourself?
Wow.
That's a fair amount. Yeah. How many successes were there? Yeah. I started doing this in 1975, I think. I built my first speakers were a pair of Speaker Lab K-Horns. And I figured out that if I bought the plans instead of the kit, I could afford a table saw. And I'd end up with a table saw, so I did that. And then I bought a real bargain basement table saw, and I used that, sorry bastard, for another 25 years. And I should have bought something better. But anyway, that's how I got started doing this. So anyway,
last one. How long is it between tests from the time one concludes to the time the next one starts?
We try to do it just as fast as we can. Our turnaround is about 6 minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
One very last.
Yeah.
What is average dynamic range of whatever your source is? Or have you ever measured that? You're talking about maximum loud and, you know, soft.
Do
you have any idea?
No, I don't. We should try that sometime. It depends on the music that they select, that the judges select. if it's a rather robust orchestral stuff, it might be a little bit louder than the average, so to speak. Some of it, if it's just a vocal, and we get some of that too, it wouldn't be as loud, I wouldn't think.
Normally. Well, I'm talking about dynamic range.
Actually. Yeah, I know what you're talking about, but it's kind of iffy, really. It's a good question, though. I wish I had a good answer. Yeah.
The driver selection, they had to be from currently available products?
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, that's a good question. That gets into the rules. And I can tell you that how we do that is the only thing that your speaker assigns to a section is how many ways it is. You have a three-way, a two-way, a single speaker, you know. Then we ask that you put down how much money you've got in the speaker. And the only things that are counted are the crossover components and the drivers. Now, obviously, if you got an uncle who sells you some drivers that cost you, you know, retail for $900 a piece, he gives them to you for, what, a buck? That's a little out of line. If you get them on sale now, you know, Radio Shack for years would have sales. And you could get some pretty good deals. Well, if it was offered to the public in general, then it's okay. But it has to be somewhat reasonable, too. And so it's the drivers and the crossovers, and that is the criteria we use for assigning it to a certain group. We'd have like under $150, over $150, you know, three-way. And if you bought them on sale, you know, it's generally known that these drivers go on sale, then there's no penalty to that.
How much were these?
Huh?
How much were these?
You'll get to it. Oh, yeah. Okay. I only got 85 more slides to go, so thank you.
Yeah, I get a little wordy, so anyway, thank you.
Good job. Cool. Yeah, these, I think I'm about $1,200 in these for parts. So as you start buying those coils and capacitors, boy, they outrun the price of the drivers pretty fast. But the quick rundown is, what, these are 15 each? That's $42, and that's $250 just for the drivers.
Yeah.
So I'm going to, it warms my heart to see so many people like to build speakers. I thought maybe I'd be talking to an empty room here today. This is fantastic. So quickly, I'm going to go through kind of my design requirements. And then I thought, well, what order do you go? So I'm just going to go through the drivers, tweeters, or woofer. And then my goal is to kind of just outline the tool set I use. It's kind of like a design review to make people aware of the free and almost free software tools now that are available out there. All of that information's on the last couple slides after the end, and so I assume those slides will be available on the web and whatnot in the future, so you can go and refer to those and see where you get all of this stuff, so no worries about that. We'll get caught up here. So, so when you think about speakers, there's only a handful of actual parameters. You got to decide, well, where's it going to play to? Is it going to play omnidirectional? Is it going to play a very narrow field? And then dipole, is it going to play negative out the back and positive out the front? And so in thinking about this contest, I realized I wanted as much control over the sound as I could get. So I went with this idea of let's just kind of focus it forwards. Let's try not to involve the ceiling. Let's not get the back of the room. I don't know exactly. I'm not going to be up against a wall the way they set these up. Kind of in the middle of the room, so I'm going to need some substantial bass. So those are the kind of things going through my mind. Ideally, if you can get constant directivity over a wide range of frequencies. That's a good thing, according to this man named Geddes. And he's got, if I'm saying that incorrectly, I don't know, but he's got some great videos on YouTube that you can watch where he explains that. I highly recommend looking at those. To control the directivity, there's ways to do that. One of them is to do a little line array like I did here. And the other typical, really common, is to have a point source, which you, most speakers that you see today are point sources versus big long line arrays. See, what else can you do? You don't want it to sound like it's in a box. The nice man, Peter Excel, of Audio Critic magazine, he's now in his mid-90s, so he doesn't publish actually anymore, but you can go read all the past issues of Audio Critic magazine for free on the web. I encourage you to do that. He talked about no monkey coffins. He says every box speaker in the world sounds like a box speaker because you hear the box. So my goal was, well, how can I eliminate noises associated with a box? So that's no resonances, no energy storage. And then, if, you know, if you could just make the best speaker in the world, well, you'd make it like a piece of wire, except it turned, you know, electrical signals into air pressure with no, you know, flat frequency response, and it's very linear, so if you can get it, which results in low distortion. Boy, I gotta find the right button to push here. This is gonna be a real long talk. What is it that we're pushing? Oh, I'm pushing.
Great.
Okay. I just bought this thing. Bear with me. Okay, so there we go. So that starting with a tweeter, what I actually thought was, gee, I'd like to have all the sound perceptually come from one place. So boy, could I make a full range speaker? Or nearly full range speaker. What came to mind was the Bose concept. I'm not a huge fan of the Bose speakers for other problems they have, but one thing they do, this is the frequency response of a Bose satellite and a Bose woofer, is they get an awful lot of the sound to come out of that satellite for its size. 500 hertz, kind of to 20 kilohertz-ish. What's his name here? There it is. Tool wrote a book on this effect of what frequencies are useful for your brain to locate where things are. And he kind of says, well, this 500 hertz range up to 7 kilohertz is pretty important. So if you can get that all to come out of one driver, that's neat. Is a way to look at that. So with that in mind, I started thinking, okay, I'd like my driver to cover that range in one driver if I can do that. To hit my other goals, I want that driver to be a piston. I don't want it flexing. I don't want it breaking up when you get mid-range cones and you try to push them to high frequencies, you know, your little 3-inch cone mid-range. Well, the thing starts to bend. So I thought, well, all right, I want to avoid that. And then if possible, I want a linear driver, a low distortion driver. Along the way, oh boy, is this going to work? Let's see here. Well, I have a video I don't know how to start. All right, anyway, well, it's an animation I don't know how to make go. What it was going to do is flex. So this is a free software tool called...
That doesn't work.
This is a video of a free software tool. And what it lets you do is put in arbitrary geometries. It's finite element analysis. And so I just to see, well, all right, I'll put a 1-inch dome in, and I will run this thing. And what it does is it computes the bending modes of the shape you put in there. And so this thing, its first bending mode kind of has this, both sides kind of get crushed in, and it kind of does this odd-looking thing. And so if you build one of these that's 1 inch across and you make it out of thin aluminum or titanium and you put those properties in here, it'll tell you, oh, yeah, the first bending mode is up at 24 kilohertz. That's real good. So kind of helps you understand why there are metal dome tweeters in the world, because that shape and some metal, and you can have a piston, something that maintains its shape up to a very high frequency.
What's so that software?
Lisa, I believe. And so it's on the very last slide. I list all of these, so you could find it and links to it. So I went out looking for a 1-inch dome that would play down to lower frequencies than most 1-inch domes do. And so with the advent of all these flat screen TVs, people said, hey, let's make some long throw little drivers. And so I came across this guy at the Parts Express catalog, pushed the right button, and I can do a laser. So this is the distortion versus frequency, which you can't quite read, but it is on the order of, they say it's under 1%. I've measured these, and at decent listening levels, they are actually down like 55 dB, the first harmonic, which is, so 60 dB is 0.1% distortion. So they're approaching, you know, maybe they're in the 0.4% range
reasonable. What frequency range is that?
And so they will maintain that low distortion. My plot actually started to rise right around 700 hertz, 600 hertz. So that was my clue to go, okay, I can run this driver down to that frequency, cross over to the next one, and I can have, you know, in the order of 0.2% something, 0.3% distortion at listening levels out of this driver from
pretty good.
700 hertz up. Fantastic.
220 to 1.5 megahertz. I'm reading that right.
Well,
response range.
Well, it let's see.
Kilohertz.
It's kilohertz. So that's 20 kilohertz with the top line.
Fit down.
Yep.
I'm looking at the spec side.
Oh.
Range plus minus whatever it is, and it says 220 hertz. 220
hertz to 1.5 kilohertz.
Oh, he's going, okay.
There you go.
Thank you. It looks like megahertz from over here.
Yep. It's all good.
You're off axis.
That's yeah, exactly.
45 degree cutoff
point. So, a nice man who shares, well, I share a name with Olson back in 1969, did these baffle diffraction studies, which everybody's probably familiar with, but.
Don't think anything of it.
Is yeah. Is the bottom right one a what?
Toilet roll.
So, yeah. So that's a 24-inch sphere with a 1-inch diameter driver on it. And I assume that's a 24-inch across cylinder. Thank you. And so you can see, boy, you'd really like to have something that doesn't have sharp edges on it, because bad things happen. That's what you learn from this plot. And the other thing you learn from this plot is, no matter what shape you have based on its size, you are going to get this baffle step. So you're going to have to learn to deal with that.
Is that Harry Olson?
I think so.
Yeah.
I should. Your drivers that you're using, those are sealed back, aren't they?
They are not.
They're open back.
That was one of the things that led to a lot of work. Which I'll get to in about 3 slides. We're going to delve into that deeply. So back in the 80s, this man, Arnold Newdell, was at Infinity, and he cottoned onto this idea of smooth baffles to lower this baffle diffraction. And so I kind of had some of these in the back of my mind, as you can see from what I ended up building. There we go. So I went off and experimented with this 1-inch driver for about a year. I started off a little bit too ambitious. I put 20 of them on 1/4 of a sphere. And pretty good. good.
Actually, yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah. And each
you mean one quarter of a sphere.
Yeah, it literally was a sphere. I took Olson at his word. And then each one had its own this is car heater hose, and each hose is stuffed with recording studio foam that you put on the walls, that acoustic foam. Because I found out if you went through 36 inches of that, you would be 60 dB down at 800 hertz. So I wanted 36 inches of it. So I did 18 inches, reflection come back, and so I was gonna be right there, man. And I took this to the show a year ago, and it sounded pretty good, but man, it was crappy on these female vocals, and it made me crazy. And I finally came to realize that, you know, I did a lot of testing with just one of them on there, and then I went and did the whole thing. With one of them on there, you have whatever it is, 0.7 grams of cone mass up against this bowl, which weighs, I don't know, a couple kilograms or more, 5 kilograms, whatever, several pounds. And that doesn't really move it. Everything is pretty fine. So most of the sound comes out of the thing that's moving the cone, and not much sound comes out of the rest of it. Would you put 20 of these dogs on here, now you're 20 times 0.7 grams, and what it does is it just bends that bowl. And it occurred to me when I was messing around the back with the crossover that I heard more sound out of the back of that than I heard coming out of the front. And that's when you know you've messed up. Yeah.
No, you just didn't build
it. Yeah. But it's sealed in the back. You get it? It's all sealed. So it was literally bending the bowl, and because the surface area of the bowl is bigger than the surface area of the cones, you don't have to move as far to make as much sound. So that was a kind of revelation.
There's not much bowl left when you cut all those holes in it, too.
Well, I have a second half shell that goes around the back, and it was all connected together, and there was a little hole cut, but yeah.
But the wood,
structurally, yeah, there's very little structure left, and that definitely plays into it. I thought maybe the weight of these rubber hoses was going to do something, but of course it's soft, and it's compliant, and it just... Those little drivers with their little lightweight magnets, that's the other thing. Your typical one-inch dome tweeter you're used to has a several-pound magnet, like a woofer magnet on it, right? But these are the little sumerium cobalt or whatever, the rare earth magnets. They don't weigh a thing. So the driver itself is so light, it's kind of created this issue that I wasn't familiar with. So I started putting it on a... Let's go make this as bad as I possibly can. Let's just put it on a quarter-inch sheet of plywood. That's as bad as it's going to get. Played with that a little bit, and then played with and the sound was fantastic when I did that in some ways because of the directivity became what I wanted. And then I also looked at this cylinder over here at the directivity with that. Let's see. We're going to... Oh, man. I've switched my slides around. There we go. So the thing I want to talk about out of order is, so how do you cure that? Well, this guy, if there's a Frenchman in the audience that could pronounce that...
Gilles.
Yes. Formerly of Audax Labs, he has this company called Lead H in France. They don't sell in the U.S., so has anybody ever seen these before? Not a soul. So he has this idea of, well, if you can keep the driver still, you eliminate the setting off all this in the cabinet, all this motion. He does it by an active bucking driver. So he puts drivers back to back. So this is his woofer, if you can imagine. There's one on each end. And so they just work against each other, and the whole cabinet stays still. His cabinet's ceramic. It's, I don't know, a quarter inch thick. It's just unbendable.
Are they both facing each other, and we're looking at the magnet part of it?
So these are very unusual drivers. They have, if you could imagine, this is the part that's moving.
That's the cone.
That's the cone. And imagine that this is the bottom of a can of pop that's been cut in half. That's how far into the cabinet it goes. It's a, so there is basically half a pop can worth of former. And then what it's riding on are two ferrofluid bearings. So he has magnets in this thing, radially facing poles, and it goes north out, south out, north out, so it's alternating. And because of that, when you put ferrofluid between that former and the magnet, it goes to the two gaps, and it puts it under pressure, and it actually suspends the thing just like they were O-rings. But they're liquid O-rings. And so he's effectively got this speaker that has no spider, no surround, no spring constant whatsoever. It's just a piston that slides back and forth as much as you want. Just, and the only thing that keeps it in there is the air. But his concept was, and he talks about this in, and I reference it at the back in this article, he says, well, I can either build anvils, which are going to be heavy, so somebody here did that, or I can do these bucking drivers. So he chose the elegant method and did these bucking drivers back to back. And in fact, on the mid-range and tweeters, he's got inside there just a weight. It's another driver, but it has no cone. It's just weighted to match the cone, so there's no acoustic output from it. It just literally provides the equal and opposite force to hold the whole cabinet still.
Have you seen the Duvalier Phantom?
Yes.
It's like a bowling ball size. It also is
back-to-back woofers. Yeah.
Still at max output if you put your hand on it.
Yeah.
There's no vibration.
And he's talking about this spherical, almost spherical speaker that you can listen to over at Definitive Audio. And I recommend going and seeing those. They're pretty amazing. So the other way to do it, if you don't want to buy twice as many drivers, is you just put an anvil behind each one. So that's what I did. So I said, my goal, I want to be 60 dB down. Let's just put 1,000 times the cone weight on the back of that driver, and it's not going to move. It's going to move 1/1,000th. It's going to have F equals MA. It will have 1/1,000th the acceleration of the cone. Thus, you've seen my steel pipes behind my tweeters, and you can't see it, but there is a 12-pound half of a...
let's turn that around.
Oh, wait. Oh, we'll get to it. Yeah. Well, there's really nothing to see in the... But...
Don't break. Oops.
That's all good. Yeah. But, yeah, you can see. I'll have a slide on it later.
Yeah.
But all right. So back to so we handled the not putting energy into the cabinet with the weight. Jeff Bagby, fantastic man, has this free software out there for all of us to use to predict the frequency response aberrations caused by baffle diffraction. And so I used his deal here. So the dotted line shows where the curvature begins on the cabinet. And so this is supposed to be my cabinet, effectively, so tall and so wide. And then you put the driver. So you could just put one driver in here. So I put one tweeter there. And so with one tweeter right there, you get this response. And if you move it over a skosh, you get that response. And so you go, gee, if I put it closer to one edge, I'm up and down maybe 1 dB. I put it a little more to the middle, and I'm up and down a little more, 2 dB maybe. One, yeah. So I used that to help me decide the position on the baffle. All right. And so then to look at the effects of the weight. Sorry if I'm skipping around here. So this was... back to our unweighted driver on the piece of plywood. There's my frequency response. This is, again, some free, well, almost free software. ARTA is this measurement software that you can get. You can use the demo for free. you can buy it for $80, and then it allows you to save your whatever you measure. You can save it. Otherwise, it's just gone when you turn it off. This was with a bucking driver, so I actually put end-to-end, just like my French friend did. And I got some interesting behavior because, well, now you've got a very short tube and drivers, and you've got waves going in both directions, and they come back pounding through, and so there's a resonance here because of that. And then I did my steel pipe, and lo and behold, my steel pipe looked pretty good, I thought. So, and again, that was just on this very thin piece of plywood, so it's very flexible. And then in those were done at 12 inches, so measurement is very tricky. This is done at near field, right across the front of the driver, so you see it's much smoother, obviously. But that's kind of illustrating what I'm getting out of that driver, and it also shows you these are the distortion, the harmonics, second, third, fourth harmonics, and so you can see they're 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, almost 60 dB down. So it's just a really amazing driver.
That's these enclosures, one driver firing?
Yeah. So I just put the mic up to one of them, right on top of it, basically at an angle, so it would reflect in.
Is that at about roughly 200 cycles where the second harmonic is pretty much dominates?
Yeah, this guy here. Yeah. So if you, that's the color of the second harmonic. And so this kind of illustrates also where I said, oh, time to stop using this driver somewhere around 700 hertz.
And, just to make sure I've got it straight, second harmonic in this parlance means the octave above the, as it were, root, I mean the fundamental.
Absolutely. Yes, perfect. All right, so we are close to 45 minutes. Do we want to bang through a few more slides or take a break now?
I think you're good.
Keep rolling.
Should we go to nine more?
We're in the seats.
All right. Hallelujah. Build the speakers. All right. So now we need a mid-range. So how do you select a mid-range? Well, mid-range, the guys who sell these things and the guys who make these things apparently don't like to tell you all the things they do when they test them. Because you can call them and ask, hey, how much harmonic distortion does your driver have, and they say, we don't have that anywhere written down that we can send you, sir. So what do? You buy them all. So I spent about $1,200, and I bought every one I liked. And then you carefully test them with clip leads, and then you return the losers, except the ones that are really beautiful and you can't part with them. So you hide them in your garage or your friend's house or in your trunk. Some of them are just too beautiful to send back, like those. So this is my echoic chamber where I do all my testing. So you can see my 20 driver. Never throw that away. And I don't really know that much about testing, so I just started doing it. And so I put it on my padded stool here, put the mic right there. Friedrich Linkwitz has a fantastic website. Such a generous man to share all his knowledge with the world. I recommend you go do some reading there. I just copied his tests because they looked really good. So he does a couple of tests. One is a tone burst where he does this five cycles of sine wave that's ramped in and ramped back out smoothly. So it's not, if you just start a sine wave, you've really added a bunch of other frequencies than the one you think you're putting in. So you need to window it, they say. And so I found a way to do that with my software. And he also, and so that allows you to see how quickly the energy comes out of the driver. Well, how quickly the driver responds to that burst of energy and how long it releases that stored energy. Some of these drivers will ring, right? And so that it'll keep playing long after you've stopped telling it to play. So it's an indication of that. The other test he does, which is a variation on a harmonic distortion, it's just a two-tone test. And I found it useful for really showing the nonlinearities. And so you play, you know, for this I was kind of going down to the lower range of where I'm going to use this driver, so the 135 hertz and 165 hertz at the same time. And I thought, gosh, you know, this seems kind of esoteric. Is this really audible? But when you play those two tones and a bad driver, it's actually audible. You hear the other tones. It's like, oh, why is it just, it just sounds different. And so seemed valuable, so I went ahead. This is just a screen to show you how to do it, should you have the software open. Some of these aren't obvious, but this is the, so this was the tone burst. So you say, I want a sine burst, I want five cycles, I want it at some level. This Blackman window says how it ramps in and ramps back out again. Just to allow you to do it without buying the $2,000 software that Linkwitz uses. That's what the test tone looks like, actually coming out of a very good driver. It's just the five cycles, and it should end exactly like it starts. You can see it kept going a little bit here, but that's what you're looking for. The way you grade it is you look at the energy. So you effectively kind of square that waveform so that you can get this energy waveform. And so if you just feed the output of the sound card back into the input of the sound card, it looks like the world's best speaker. It's perfect. And that's what this, whatever, gray, or I'm not sure if that's a little bit blue or whatever. So that's your reference. It went up and went back down because the tone burst ended completely. It's down, this is 60 dB here, the bottom of this chart, 0 dB at the top. And then this is a good driver. And Linkwitz, he looks for the time for the thing to get 30 dB down. That's how he grades his drivers. So he records that time from the reference to where the driver is actually quieted down that much. That makes sense.
Can you mention having the output go to the input of the sound card? Is that for a reference level?
Mm-hmm. Well, it just gives me some place to just say, okay, if the driver was absolutely perfectly quick, yeah, stored no energy, what would it look like? Okay. Yeah.
And since it's a time measurement, wouldn't you need that reference?
Yes. So you need something. I mean, you can just do the drivers relative to each other as well. Pick the best. Yeah. It's kind of arbitrary.
Straight wire again.
Yeah, yeah. This is the two tones. So if you, I didn't throw it in here because so many slides, but if you go in to out on the sound card, sound card will go all the way to minus 120 dB down. I mean, just, it's just dead, and there's two spikes, and that's it. Just perfect, right? And so here's a driver. This one, what is it? We're like 10, 20, 30, 40 something dB down before we get to our first harmonic. So these are the two spikes I wanted. That's what I put in, my 135 and my one, whatever it was, 165. Thank you. And then it generated these other ones because it's doing multiplication. If it was a linear system, it wouldn't do any multiplication. So that's, and then you get these interesting, really, these subharmonics too. So a lot goes on with these drivers. Not sure why I threw another one in here. Here's another. This happens to be the driver I selected. That's the 7-inch Dayton driver. So I did this for a variety. Linkwitz does a bunch of drivers. He didn't happen to do the one I picked, so I tried to reproduce his results, kind of got there, close enough that I thought things were working, and then did a bunch, and this C's driver was, at least for the two-tone test, the best. It's a bigger driver. That's an 8-inch driver. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the 7-inch driver. There's the 8-inch driver. Anyway, And because I wasn't planning on presenting this, I didn't do all the tests. So the matrix is not full. This was one. Oh, that's a good one. So these C's drivers are $275, and this Dayton driver is $41. So guess what? It was good enough. All right. So mid-range selection, low frequency cutoff, you have a few things you got to do. You got to put it in a box. You got to put it in the right size box. You've got to handle the resonance of the air cavity in the box. You've got to handle the bending of the box. So I thought, well, if I had the perfect box, let's put the first resonant frequency out of the range I'm ever going to use this driver. Then I'll never hit it. And so how do you do that? Well, you use a small enough driver. You need a driver that needs a small volume. So, for instance, the C's driver wanted a big volume, like the 8-inch. It wanted, I don't know, 27 liters, something like that. And I'm like, okay, the sides get real big, the volume gets real big, the first resonant mode's down at 280 hertz, something. It's like, ah, shoot, that's right in my range. Can't have that. The Dayton driver needed a very small volume, whatever that is. It's like a 7x7x7 internal cube, and it worked great. And so to kind of figure this out, what volume your speaker needs, you can use software. This is, I can't see it. Anyway. Software that's named later in the presentation that you can get for free, and it lets you. That's why I'm confused. Sorry, got out of whack. So this is actually measuring the driver. So this is Woofer Tester 3 from Parts Express or Dayton. And so you buy this little device, you hook it up. It's an impedance meter. It does a sweep. Here is the impedance versus frequency. It will derive these feel small parameters, which is your spring constant, your damping. And that then with those for the driver, because they aren't what the specs say they're going to be, you can go into this other software that I thought I was looking at, got confused, the WinISD, which is free. And then you can, this is three different designs. Some sealed, some vented. I think these were, this happened to be for my woofer. But anyway, and so you can see what volume will do to the low-end response. That's all you're really affecting is the low-end response because it's adjusting the spring constant. All you're doing with your box is making the spring tighter, so it's going to resonate at a higher frequency. That's it. Smaller box, tighter spring, higher resonant frequency. Now you know all about feel small. So then you go, well, all right, let's go see where I've decided on a box volume. Let's go over to some software called Box Notes. And I'm going to put in the dimensions of my box, and it's going to tell me where the Helmholtz resonances are, which is like, think of an organ pipe, the air, the column, the dimensions of the air volume that has the speed of sound and how long it is determines the frequency that's going to bounce back and forth and add up and resonate. So that's all this does. It says, oh, what's the internal dimensions in each direction? And if you build a cube, which no one ever tells you to do when you build a mid-range enclosure, don't do it. God, all the resonances will line up on top of each other. It'll be hell. Well, that's what I did. So because I had a very specific goal of making the lowest resonance out of the range I'd ever use the driver. So if you build a cube, you can have the shortest dimensions possible. So it's just a little different. It's not quite as high as you'd like, but that's all right. This is 950 hertz. So there's actually four of them stacked up right here at 950. So if you were to go and shift the box, make it longer in one direction, then these would, that bottom line would split out into several, into three lines, and they'd go, you'd probably have one at 600 and one at 800, whatever, right? That's what most boxes do. So they're, most of the speakers you've ever bought, these beauties right here have resonances right in the range that you're listening to them. Don't want that. Don't have to have that. Build a cube.
What is the highest frequency that you are going to use? Was around 7?
Yes, yes.
And so 950 or whatever that was.
It's not as high as you'd like it to be. So there's other things you do that helps get rid of that. And what that is severe stuffing, high-density stuffing. So most of the stuffing you find in boxes is, forget the units, but 1 kilogram per cubic meter, something. I don't know. It's lightweight stuff, fluffy stuff, right? Mm-hmm. If you just fill them with acoustic foam, hey, it'll be like 16. And what happens is it just gobbles up all of that energy. This fine software, transmission lines is what it's called, and there's a reference at the back, allows you to put in arbitrary cabinet cross sections. So you can put in, it's kind of a 1D model. You can, anyway, you can say basically the cross section, and then you can change it. So it's real good at making transmission lines where it might be like a rectangle. And so you could, so what I did is I kind of cheated. I made my bowl shape here by making a really short multi-stage transmission line. But in any case, as you put the stuffing in there, it will show you all those resonances that we saw in the previous software. They'll show up as big ripples. So if you actually, and then as you load up the density of your foam, those ripples just go away. So 950 hertz is high enough that acoustic foam is actually effective in getting rid of it. As you get lower than that, the effectivity of the foams become lower and lower and lower. So so it's in the range that's still useful. Panel resonances. Well, gee, wouldn't it be neat if we all had expensive finite element software and we knew how to run it? Well, I don't. But I found this fine man, Tom Irvine, who has a MATLAB script that he gives out for free on the internet. And all it does is calculates the resonance of a plate, a rectangular plate. You put in the size and the thickness and the material you want. And you can even do it as a sandwich with a core and 2 skins. So you can do some pretty neat things. But it's just super simple because all it does is a plate. So you just go through and you enter, oh, I got this plate, it's that thick. That's it. You just answer the questions. And then you tell it how it's constrained, which means how each edge is held. Is it hinged or is it stiff? Just real simple things. And that's all the questions you answer. And then it kicks out the resonant frequency of that panel. And so you go, oh, okay, I've made this panel out of plywood. I went and figured out some approximate numbers for the material properties of plywood, and I stuck them in this program. And it came out with, hey, there's 581 hertz for my 7x7-inch panel of 3/4-inch birch plywood. Not quite high enough. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to brace it and make it a smaller panel until I get my first resonant mode above my operating range. So that's basically what I did. But yeah, it just shows you here. It's kind of cool. It shows you the mass, because you go, oh, in that first bending mode, it's actually like a drum head, so there's a lot of mass involved. Yes?
Yeah, so if you take a panel and then you brace it right
mm-hmm.
in the middle, do you consider it half the size then?
Yeah. I mean, if it's perfectly braced, which it probably isn't, but yeah, yeah. Eventually you have to just go build something, but yeah.
I'm sorry.
So there are some. Here's a brace.
Oh, I see.
That's a brace. It's not going anywhere, that particular one. Maybe the and then the other ones are internal and they're limited to the internal dimensions of the box, of course.
Is that plywood panel or cellular panel?
It's plywood, so it's a birch plywood.
Okay.
Which is, yeah.
So the thing really does is that calculating on a solid wood panel. Which would make your results completely worthless if you're doing plywood, which of course is multiple pieces, or particle board, which is a lot scary.
Well, it's going to be an approximation. So when I go and cut out a 7x7-inch piece of plywood and I wrap on it and I measure it, it comes out within 100 hertz of that. It's all, you know, it's engineering. you know, the physicist approaches the girl half at a time, never gets there, and the engineer just walks over and kisses her. So this is just showing the mode shapes. So this is the first mode, like I said, like the drum head, and here's the higher mode. And there's Howard's beautiful German saw that cuts wood straight, even if it starts off crooked. I really want to get one of those.
Is that a fine?
You lay this piece of metal, which is a track, and you don't clamp it. It just sits there.
You actually don't even have to clamp it.
And then you just run the saw, and it cuts exactly there. So cool. So Howard cut those pieces, and we got the first box built. And there's a response in the box. Things are looking pretty good. There's still some whoop-de-doos. This was before the weight was put in. And I went and said, hey, what about, let's put the thing on the weight. And should we do the break now?
Yeah.
All right. Lots are sore. Everybody gets to stand up. And this is, you'll see what the weight does up after the break.